You'll turn your folders to page 22. That's where we're starting this morning. We're going to finish quickly lesson 10, and then we'll start in lesson 11, Exodus 32. But we have just one question to finish up. If there's anybody that's new, since this is the start of a new quarter, that doesn't have the lesson, she'll be happy to bring you a copy if you need one. Three or four should do. Anybody else need a copy? All right. Anybody else? All right. If you're new to the quarter, this last quarter and this quarter is devoted to going through the Old Testament, just looking at various stories that are familiar to us, stories that can be perceived as faith builders. Not so much going through the text verse by verse or whatever, just talking about it some and trying to think of some New Testament passages that give us some similar instruction along some of the points that are found in these stories. And the quarter ended with us talking about the story of redemption, that is, the redeeming of Israel from bondage. These 12 chapters together, Exodus 3 through 14. We got toward the end of that before class ended last Wednesday. At this point, we're in chapter 14, and Pharaoh, of course, is pursuing Israel. They come to the Red Sea. That's, of course, where Moses will part the Red Sea. And Israel will be redeemed, and Egypt will be destroyed. So their complaint at the water, were not enough graves, Moses, in Egypt, that you've got to bring us out here and have us slaughtered by the Egyptians. Not faithful words, but fearful words. And, of course, Moses' great reply, Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord. This is chapter 14 and verse 13. You will never see the Egyptians again forever. Paraphrasing that verse. So Moses rescues them and he parted the Red Sea. So this is where we ended up last time. 1 Corinthians 10, Paul makes mention of the baptism into Moses, how they were surrounded on both sides by water, the cloud above and the cloud behind them, though passing through on dry land. And this is where we got to. This is the last question 16. I wanted you to think about comparing Jesus and Moses as redeemers. Moses being a type of a redeemer like Christ. So I want you to think a little bit outside the box, if you will, and think about the things that Moses did in this story, and then think of some New Testament passages where we might find some correlation or some similar teaching between what Moses did for them versus what Christ does for us. So here's some ideas that I came up with, and perhaps you have some similar ideas. Moses was a spokesman for God, wasn't he? And these earlier chapters, chapter 3 and chapter 4, again, what was it that that God told Moses to do when he got to Pharaoh? Page 22, Scott. Where we are. What was the mission that he gave Moses at the burning bush? What did he tell him? All right, I need you to go talk to Pharaoh. You go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. So he was the spokesman. And Moses offered up those excuses, but we know that finally Moses was convinced. Well, is Christ a spokesman? In fact, he's the last greatest spokesman, isn't he? Hebrews 1:1-2. God, who at various times and sundry ways spoke to the fathers and the prophets in times past, has in these last days spoken unto us by His Son. So he is the greatest spokesman. See the comparison. Moses is spokesman, but Christ is far greater. All right? Secondly, and turn to Hebrews 3, and that's actually the passage I've got cited in the question. Hebrews 3, the first six verses, the Hebrew writer compares Christ and Moses. Really a lot through the book. He compares Christ and Aaron as high priest. That's the latter chapters. But in the early part of the book, he makes some good comparisons between Christ and Moses. Notice in Hebrews 3, and this is not to disparage Moses, it's just to put Moses in his proper place. He says, Moses was faithful as a servant in the house. In the house. What does it say about Christ? He was faithful as a son over the house. And so Christ, Moses, both were servants. Both served God, both did the Father's will. But Moses is not divine. Moses was not divine. He was a servant, faithful servant in the house, emphasis. Christ was the son, faithful son over the house. The writer says, in whose house we are if we hold fast, if we do not quit. And again, in context, the Hebrew Christians to whom he was writing needed to not go back to the law, but to stay with the gospel. So there's another comparison. All right. Obviously, Moses redeemed them from physical bondage. The words of God in chapter 3, verse 7, chapter 6, verses 6 through 7. He said, I have indeed heard the cry of my people, and I will redeem them from their slavery, from the house of bondage. But what about us? Christ says, have we been in bondage? See, we're in slavery too. Jesus said in John 8, verse 34, he who commits sin is a slave of sin. And can even Christians go back to bondage? Well, they can. Acts 8 and verse 23, you have the story of Simon the sorcerer. When Peter Peter and John are sent to Samaria, and at Philip's preaching, Simon obeyed the gospel, but then later on, Peter and John get there and they're laying their hands upon the new disciples and giving them the Holy Spirit. What was it that Simon did, remember? He offered them money. Give me this gift also, that on whomever I lay my hands I may impart the Holy Spirit. And Peter says, You've got no part in this. Your heart's not right before God. I perceive that thou art in the gall of bitterness and in the bondage of iniquity. So he had gone back to slavery. Sin is bondage. Sin is slavery. In that great text from Romans 6, though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine that was delivered unto you. We've now become slaves of righteousness. So again, we see these great comparisons. Israel redeemed from their bondage. We've been redeemed from ours. All right, two more quick ones that I thought of. In Exodus 12, what was it that they had to offer? The Passover feast? They had to slay the lamb, but they had to take the blood and dip some hyssop in it and smear it on the doorpost and across the lintel or the top beam. That had been on the inside or the outside of the house? Well, on the outside, obviously. And what was the purpose for that? All right, the destroyer, God, or whoever it was he was using. I think I said an angel in the class last time. I'm not sure that it was an angel. Psalm 78 is one passage that came to mind that might indicate that God used an angel in passing over Egypt that night. But whoever it was that God used was called the destroyer. And so when he saw the blood, so they had to be saved from death by the blood of the Lamb. Does that sound familiar? Let's see, that's New Testament teaching. Again, what did John say in John 1, verse 29? Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. Speaking of Christ, of course. And then again in Hebrews 9, the writer mentions how that Christ, as our high priest, did he go into the most holy place? Christ. Yes, he did. Did he take blood with him to make atonement for the people? Yes, but whose blood did he take? The blood of an animal? No, his own blood. That's the point the writer makes. So again, we're saved we're redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. And finally, the last thing I thought of was that this redemption had a baptism. Again, the passage we mentioned last week, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 2, Paul said that they were all baptized into Moses, baptized into this relationship with Moses, following his direction, following his teaching. Well, does our redemption have a baptism? Well, it does. We can't be redeemed without it. Mark 16, 16, Acts 2, 38, Acts 22, 16, wash away thy sins. 1 Peter 3, 21, baptism doesn't also now save you. And we could go on, but I just want you to think, maybe you got some different points than these, but these are just things that make us think, when we think about Israel's redemption and their freedom from sin or freedom from physical bondage, we need to be thinking about our freedom from our own bondage, the bondage of sin, and how our great Redeemer paid the price just like they had to slay the lamb back there to pay their price. Okay, anything else through the story of the release from Egyptian slavery that anybody thought of? Comments or questions? All right, turn to page 23. Now, this is lesson 11, and we'll skip ahead several chapters to chapter 32 now. Israel is a free nation, of course, by this time, but this is not one of her better moments. We're going to call this a story of rebellion. And if you look at the short introductory paragraph there, when someone is a when some being is a benefactor, when someone does something great for a person or a group of people, that ought to induce in the people who've been benefited, you know, thankfulness and faithfulness and obedience, thoughtfulness, those kinds of things. And so Israel has been redeemed by God. He was their benefactor. But on this occasion, they showed, and God is entitled to such treatment, but that is not so. Paul says in Romans 1 that that they did not honor God, nor did they give thanks to Him. We need to be a thankful people. And on this occasion, Israel showed anything but thankfulness. They showed rebellion, and they showed human thinking in terms of wanting to have a God to be their leader. So a redeemed Israel, she's free now, but she eventually violated the covenant that God gave at the mountain, and she seriously rebelled. And so we need to look at this. The golden calf story is well known. Even the small children know the story. But we can read it, think about it some, and see how it can help our own faith today. Look at these things when we go through the story. Things like anger, and I mean divine anger, divine disappointment. This is what God felt. Failure of people. On Moses' part, the absence of self-will, and we'll talk about that. And mediation for sin. These are all just relevant topics that we need to think about today just as much as they need to think about them when this story took place. All right, so looking now in chapter 32 at some of the early verses in the chapter. Actually, before we get to chapter 32, look at question 1. And let's think just for a moment about things that Israel had seen prior to this moment. Now, we've referenced you back to chapter 7 through 14 chapters we just finished in the previous lesson. What did Israel see back in those chapters that we just got through talking about? What had she witnessed? All right, the Red Sea. But before the Red Sea crossing, what had she seen? That's right. God had shown His power by bringing all those plagues. He unleashed His wrath upon this nation that had held them in bondage, bringing upon them 10 destructive judgments. Israel saw that. And as we made mention in that previous lesson, in plague numbers 4 through 10, what had God done for Israel? He had spared them. He didn't bring the plague upon them. They were exempt from the destruction that came when the darkness was there, and of course when the death of the firstborn there, hail, boils, all those things, they were spared the land of Goshen. But they saw what it did. Now, you put yourself in Israel's place, what should you have thought when you saw that about God? He's taking care of us. I'm on His side. He's my God. All right, and I'm impressed with what this God can do. Now, Roger mentioned, secondly, they saw the Red Sea. I mean, they were there. They saw that water just divide like that, and through they went. They saw not only their own salvation, but what about the Egyptians? They saw their destruction. They saw God bring the, through Moses, they saw God bring the water back over them and destroy them utterly, drowned every one of them. On the other side of the sea, chapter 15, we didn't read that chapter, but Moses led them in the Song of Moses, or the Song of the Lamb. They sang a victory song, a song of thanksgiving to God. So they weren't told this, they lived it. They saw it. They experienced it. So they saw that. And also, she and when they come to Mount Sinai, now chapter 19 and 20, we're inching up here to chapter 32, as well as Deuteronomy 5, you've got to throw that chapter in also. That gives us a little more information than what is said here in Exodus 19. They come to the mount. They saw it quake violently. They saw the smoke. They smelt the burning. What did they hear? They heard God's voice. Now, someone thinks from Exodus 19, all you get is that Moses heard. Well, if you look at Deuteronomy 5, Moses tells them when he reviews what happened to them before he dies, he says in that chapter that you heard, all the people heard God's voice. And so they heard this, whatever it sounded like, must have been thunderously loud. Because after God spoke, what did the people say? We can't take this. Moses, you go talk to him. And you come back and tell us what he said. But we cannot hear the voice of God lest we die. So just quickly, these three points. They saw or witnessed all three of these things. Yet, now, question 2. This gets into chapter 32. What did she want? Was this enough evidence to produce commitment, dedication, and faithfulness? Evidence was abundantly there. But now our lesson, what did she want? Chapter 32, now the first part of verse 1. All right. Aaron, they make a request of Aaron. What did they say? Make us a god. What was the problem, and now be careful how I ask this. What was the problem with the god they had? Now, obviously, I don't mean that Jehovah's insufficient, but what's the problem? They can't see him. They've already heard his voice, but they can't see him. They can't touch him. They can't know that he's there through the human senses. Make us a god that we can see. Yes, Greg. Well, that's true, and we'll come to that. You're right. Moses was not there. Because their reason in the last part of verse 1 is what? As for this Moses, what in the world's happened to him? We don't know. He may be dead for all we know. How long was Moses gone? Probably the most popular biblical number in the Old Testament. 40. He was gone 40 days and nights up on the mountain. So, she demanded of Aaron, make us a God who go before us. The reason Moses delayed in coming down from Mount Sinai. Let's go back to chapter 24 right quick. And let's read those verses. Exodus 24. Let's start in verse 9. And let's read through verse 18. Brad, would you... My Brad, sorry. Got two Brads in here. This Brad over here. Brad, would you read 9 through 18 for us, please? That's the last time they saw Moses. All right, he's gone into the midst of this cloud, and there he is. And so in the ensuing chapters, 25 through 31, is the record of God talking to Moses, giving him different aspects of the law. Okay? And so the people here, they're just down there waiting. What did God say here? Now, if you've got a legal matter, a legal issue, well, you've got Aaron, and you've got her. You can talk to them. But Moses is gone. Well, what do we deduce when we come to chapter 32? What about their sons of Israel and their idea of waiting? Well, they've grown tired of waiting. And so they say, we don't know what's happened to Moses. What's become of him? We don't know. And we need something. Well, the reason I went through those previous slides, they had already seen enough to know they had a God. They had a leader, if you will. They're thinking in a humanistic way. We want something we can see, something tangible that we can touch and smell and see and all those kinds of things. Okay, so that's what Israel did. Well, now let's look what Aaron did. Aaron's the brother of Moses. Before we talk about what he did, what would be your expectations of Aaron? What do you think about Aaron from what you've seen so far in the story of the book of Exodus? Pretty good fellow, that's right. I mean, he was shoulder to shoulder with Moses, going right at Pharaoh. Remember Moses' excuse? I can't talk. I don't have a good tongue. What God say? Well, I'll give you Aaron, your brother. He can talk. And so Aaron has been faithful. So we would expect Aaron to do exactly what Moses would do. Well, so they come to Aaron. What'd Aaron do? What did he say? All right, give me all your gold. Well, when he says that, I mean, that's his first words. Already he's thinking what? I've got to fashion something. I've got to make something. He asked for all the people's gold, and so they give it to him. Then what does he do? This is verse 4. All right, he made a god with an engraving tool. Is that what it says? It says that in verse 4. He fashioned a calf with an engraving tool. Now, why a calf? Well, it has to be some connection to their past in Egypt, I would say. Remember, we showed one of the judgments of the plagues, disease of murrain of the cattle. They worshipped a sacred bull-headed god named Apis. Maybe that was what was in Aaron's mind. I don't know. But he fashions a calf. And then what did the people proclaim? What did they say? He presents them the calf. This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of Egypt. That's what they say. Now, after the people make that proclamation, Aaron didn't say that. The people said it, but what did Aaron do? Let's sort of legitimize this. How did Aaron try to legitimize it? He built an altar and proclaimed a feast to the Lord, not to this calf. But see, we're going to give this an air of legitimacy. Well, what do you see? And this may be an obvious question. And this is question, the last part of question three. You go back to Exodus 20. Of course, that's the Ten Commandments. Do you see anything that immediately pops out at you? Obviously, they've made a god. But remember what one of the statements that God made? Thou shalt not make any graven image. What's Aaron done? He's used an engraving tool and he's made a graven image. This is what makes Aaron's actions so disappointing. Oh, it would be wrong for anybody to do it, because that's what God said. But this is the brother of Moses, and he's been through all this with Moses. And so the people then they start to worship. The people's request and Aaron's actions were a direct violation of what God had said at Mount Sinai. They've been there no more than 40 days. I mean, it's a month, 10 days, whatever. It's not been like it's been months ago that God said this. Oh yeah, we forgot God said that. No, that's not an excuse. They just flatly wanted this, and Aaron just gave in, and he capitulated. So the people offered up sacrifices and offerings to their new idol. Turn to Acts 7, verses 40 through 41. This gives us just a little bit more information. We don't learn Lowe's lot more, but just a statement or two there that's not found here in the record. Stephen's preaching when he was stoned. What does he say about the people? This time, Brad Merle, if you'll read Acts 7, verses 40. Well, let's see. Let's start in verse 39. Read 39 through 41, please. Look how Stephen phrases the last part of verse 41. They rejoiced what? In the works of their hands. That's what an idol is. God is not made with, Acts 17, what did Paul preach at Mars Hill? God is not served by human hands as though He needed anything. Concentrate God, or you can't restrict God to a certain geographical place like you can a hunk of wood or a piece of stone or a metal fashioned in the shape of an animal. He's spirit. But they worship the work of their hands, or they serve they rejoice in the work of their hands. So they offer up their sacrifices and their offerings. They brought burnt offerings. Yes, sir. Right. Yes. That's why I said, I think Aaron's trying to give it a sense of legitimacy. They didn't say it's Jehovah, but Aaron did. And so, of course, that doesn't make it right. But they're thinking, this is a God that we can finally see. We can get a handle on this. We can sense this. This gives us something tangible. And Aaron is trying to make this all better, that's how I see it, at least through his, especially his words in verse 5. Today, or rather tomorrow, shall be a feast to the Lord. So they offer their offerings, and they sit down, and then they rose up to drink and play. They sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. What do you think's involved in them rose up to play, that they rose up to play? What do you think's involved in that? Think there was any immorality? The text doesn't say. In ancient pagan religions, well, later on in this chapter, when Moses is coming back down with Joshua, He says he hears music and dancing. We know that's involved. It was festive. It was a party. But in a lot of ancient paganistic religions, it usually involved licentious behavior, lewdness, sexual immorality, fornication that could have been involved. This text doesn't say they were doing that. I'm not going to say they did or didn't. I'm just saying that's been the case in a lot of ancient cultures. But at least we know they were having a party, frolicking about with the dancing and the music, and trying to make this just a gayous affair, a big festive occasion. So whether or not there was immorality, we'll just have to, I think, say that that's definitely a possibility. Now, I'm going to stop right here and think about something. This gets us to question 5, and this is one of the points that I want to make that I think is proper to make when you're talking about what's happened so far. And I'm going to focus on Aaron at this juncture. I believe there's a principle at work here. Look, skipping ahead to verse 21. Right, Moses has come down from the mountain now. And we'll go back and pick up the verses that we skipped, where God tells Moses to go down from the mountain. Moses gets down there by this time. What has he done with the tablets? He smashed them. Just in his anger, he smashes the tablets. What's he do with the calf? Burns it, grinds it up, sprinkles it over the water, and says what? You want this calf, you're going to have this calf. You drink this water. Makes them drink it. That must have been a bitter to swallow. And then he doesn't address the people. Notice that. Who does he talk to? He turns to his brother. And what does he say to his brother, Bobby? That'd be verse 21. What did they... Aaron... Did they tie you down? What did they do to make you do this? Now, it doesn't say that Moses was disappointed, but you can hear that in his voice, in his words. He was deeply disappointed in his brother. You know this isn't right. And I don't understand how you let this happen. Moses, of course, who's writing this book, look in verse 25. He says, when Moses saw that the people were out of control, and they were out of control, but where does the fault lie? What's it say? Aaron let them. Aaron allowed them to get out of control, to be a derision among their enemies. See, that's the concern. To be a reproach among our enemies. Of course, the main concern is that we're displeasing God in these kinds of actions. But we're giving the enemies a chance to speak reproachfully of us, and more important, to speak reproachfully of God, whom we claim to follow. And that was a huge disappointment. So his first words were directed at his brother. Aaron's reply is almost, well, not almost, it's laughable. We expect better of Aaron than this. When Moses asks the question, what did these people do to you? Well, look at his response in verse 22 to 24. What's he say? Does he get any of it right? Does he say anything truthful? Verse 22. He says, don't let your anger burn. You know the people. They're prone to evil. Well, is that true? Well, in some respects. Have they already whined and complained some between their redemption and this? They had done some of that. Okay. So that's somewhat true. What about his words in verse 23? Was that true? Yes, he said, they came to me, make us a god. As for this Moses, they don't know what happened to you. They got tired of waiting. Now, verse 24, what's he say? Whoever has any gold, let him tear it off. Was that true? That's true. Then what's he say? What did he say? And Moses, you wouldn't have believed it if you were there. Just out jumped this calf. There, isn't that amazing? You wouldn't have believed it if you saw it. Now, if you were Moses, and you're standing there listening to your brother, and he says that, what would you have thought? You've got to be kidding me. Notice, Moses doesn't even address what Aaron says. He didn't say one word about it. It wasn't worthy of a response. It was that crazy of a story. So, this is such a failure on Aaron's part. He blamed the people. Well, they shared some of the blame. That's true. They're the ones that wanted the God. But what should Aaron have done when that request came? Make us a God. We're not going to have any of that. And it was not to say, because I said so. What should Aaron have said in his reason for the answer of no? What did Jehovah say on the mountain? Do not make for yourselves any graven images. We're not going to do that. Well, but Moses is gone. We don't know what's happened to him. Aaron should have said, we're going to wait. He's going to come back. God said that He would. And we'll sit here and we'll wait. So he blamed the people. And then he lied about his own actions. I just threw it into the fire. Well, that wasn't so. He didn't throw anything into the fire. And out jumped this animal. That's a whopper. I'll tell you, there are some biblical lies, or lies in the Bible, and that's one of the biggest ones there is. That's just so far from the truth, it's almost laughable. Yes, Craig. Yeah, that's true. You're right. That's a good observation. Sin, when it's practiced or it occurs, man often tries to find a scapegoat. Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the snake. Aaron's blaming the people for their own actions. And we just can't. We can do that, but it's not going to fly. It won't work. Never has worked, never will work. Okay, so here's what Aaron's gotten himself into. So what's the principle I'm after here? And hope you can tell by the verses that I put in this question. I want you to think with me about this. This is an important principle. Aaron failed to be a spiritual leader. He failed on this occasion. Moses knew it. His direct question of his brother indicates his deep disappointment in Aaron. And godly spiritual leaders are always needed to guide God's people. Would you agree with that? They're always needed. Now, obviously, the verses that we're going to talk about here, what about our leadership today? Who do we have? Well, we're supposed to have elders, shepherds, under-shepherds to the great shepherd. And let's just take a few moments and read some of these passages here in question 5. And I want you to think about the admonitions we're given in the Scripture. I want you to think about Aaron and what he failed to do. Turn to Acts 20, 29 to 30. Craig, when you have that, would you read that for us? This is Paul coming back on the third journey. He has bypassed Ephesus, as you know the story. He's come to Miletus. Who does he call for? Who does he summon? The Ephesian elders. I got some words I want to say to you. All right. And he says a lot of things, but read 29 through 30 for us, please, Craig, of Acts 20. Who's going to protect the sheep from the wolves, the savage wolves? Well, the shepherd does that. Paul says, I know after I depart. See, now while Paul's in town, who's going to mess with Paul? Paul showed himself to be a great warrior for Christ, and he wouldn't be messed with. He's not going to put up with stuff like that. But Paul says, I know after I'm gone, savage wolves will come in not wanting to spare the flock. And that wasn't the worst of it. What was the worst of it? These wolves will come from you men that I'm talking to right now. Some of you are wolves in sheep's clothing. You'll rise up among your own selves to draw away disciples after you. You'll fail to be the kind of spiritual leader that you need to be and that God needs you to be at this local church in Ephesus. You'll fail. And so when spiritual leadership fails to be exerted and shown and displayed among God's people, error will always result. Always. We'll always have problems. Yes, buddy. Yeah. That's right. You make a good point. Are we through building our golden calves? We're not through building them. We're still making them. For one reason or another, they can take, you're right, many different forms and shapes. And the only answer to not having those calves built, of course, would be on the people's part to not have those carnal desires. But even if some of us have those desires, what is God's safety net there? Well, yes, I know, but what's a check for us? Godly spiritual leaders who will lead us and guide us. Aaron should have done that, and he failed. And we depend upon our spiritual leaders to help us, keep us from that which would harm us or be wrong or erroneous. I'm trying to make this parallel here of what we're talking about. Jesus saw the need for such leadership. He looked out among the people, felt compassion on them as sheep having no shepherd. Matthew 9, verse 36. That's how we are sometimes, just like sheep. Wandering about aimlessly, going here and there, always in need of guidance. And the Lord recognized that. Now, let's look at these passages real quickly. The New Testament certainly instructs us and emphasizes the need for godly spiritual leadership. Scott, would you turn to Hebrews 13 and verse 20? There's one more passage I want you to read from that text, so we'll stay there when you get done. And then, Roger, turn to 1 Peter 5. And let's look at verses 1 through 2. Now, what are we taught about the importance and the emphasis of this leadership? Scott, Hebrews 13, verse 20. How was Christ described in that verse? The great shepherd of the sheep. He is the shepherd. He's the leader of the flock. What did Peter say to elders, Roger? 1 Peter 5 and verse 1 and 2.
The elders which are among you, I exhort, for I am also an elder and a witness of the suffering of Christ, and also for the sake of the glory that shall be revealed. Be the flock of God which is among you, taking the elders not very well, not by the strength of the children, not by the full deliverance of the children.
Where do elders have the oversight? Based on 1 Peter 5? The flock among them. That's where it stops. But that's enough work right there. The sheep need the elder, or elders, plural, to take that oversight and to guide them and lead them. Feed them, pasture them, find them land to grain, to graze spiritually, that they may be fed and grow and prosper. Now, back in Hebrews 13 again, Scott, let's look at those who are under this leadership. What does verse 17 say? Scott. What are we taught now? To obey and to submit. What's the consequences if we don't, based on the verse Scott just read? What if we don't do that? How does the verse finish? It'll make their job harder. We don't want to do that. See, they made Aaron's job harder. Now, Aaron still shouldn't have done what he did, but they made it tougher. But how does that verse conclude? What if we don't do what that verse says? And it will not be profitable for you if you do that. And then real quickly, Norm, turn to 1 Thessalonians 5, read for verses 12 and 13.
We urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor upon you and uphold you in the Lord and admonish you and esteem them very highly and love for their work sake, who have peace among themselves.
What are we supposed to do? We're supposed to esteem these leaders because their job is heavy. It's weighty. So I know in this story we're not talking about church elders. I know that. But I see a great parallel here. All right, Aaron was left in charge to be their leader, and Aaron let them down. Look what resulted. Great travesty resulted. What about us today? Well, let's not have those yearnings for those golden calves. Let's not do that. But even if we do, in one form or another, what is there in place to help bring us back? This godly spiritual leadership. And we need men to act like spiritual men to guide us back to the path we need to go. All right, there'll be no class because of our singing on Wednesday, so we'll pick up here, the Lord willing, next Sunday, top of page 24. Thanks for your good comments, participation this morning.